from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. At least 39 civilians were reported dead, victims of aerial attacks by Saudi Arabia in Yemen. CCTV's Wang Yingqi has more.
Yemeni health ministry officials say that at least 39 civilians were killed in Saudi Arabia-led airstrikes against the Shiite rebels over in Yemen. 12 of these victims died when a raid against a military base north of the capital Sana'a hit surrounding residential areas. And at dawn on Friday, three airstrikes hit the presidential compound in South Sana'a, which these rebels seized last month. And overnight raids targeted an army brigade loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh in the eastern province of Marib. Now, Saudi military video also shows a Saudi Arabian jets bombing Yemen's Rahaba airport in Sana'a. A Saudi defense minister advisor says that Saudi Arabia has air superiority over Yemen.
We started to see the results of the operation in the first 15 minutes, and we had an absolute air control. Of course, any air operation needs a large number of jets for the offensive, the refueling, the early warning, the drones, and the search and rescue planes. It was a successful operation in which a lot of planes participated. The Saudis were at the front, and we achieved many goals in the first 15 minutes of the operation and continued until we accomplished all the set goals.
Meanwhile, the leader of the Ansarullah movement uprising in Yemen, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, slammed Saudi Arabia's intervention, calling the Saudi monarchy, quote, a troublesome, hostile neighbor, close quote. He described the Al Saud regime as puppets of the U.S. and Israel in the region. Press TV's Khaniz Fatima reports from Tehran.
Now, Abdul Malik al-Houthi described the Saudi airstrikes in Yemen as criminal and unjustified aggression, adding that Riyadh is walking on the path of occupation, destruction, and division of Yemen. He said that Israel is the first regime that felt threatened by Ansarullah victories in Yemen. Houthi added that Tel Aviv turned to Saudi Arabia because both sides have mutual interests. According to the Houthi leader, Al-Saud regime is one of the root causes of problems in Yemen. Houthi promised that Saudi Western project to chokehold the people of Yemen will fail and that the Yemeni nation, as well as the army and popular committees, will confront the invaders with full force. Houthi, however, said that the invasion of Yemen is not an easy task. He advised Egypt against selling itself out to Saudi Arabia and the U.S. Let's speak to political commentator Christopher Walker, who joins us via Skype from London. Earlier, speaking to a correspondent, he said that any ground invasion of Yemen will play into the hands of the Ansarullah movement. And over here we have Abdul Malik al-Houthi warning Saudi Arabia that any invasion will not be an easy task. What do you make of it?
Well, I think what they say is true. But on the other hand, as we know, from recent history in a number of wars in the Middle East, air power alone will never really obtain any sort of victory. So the Saudis, even though they may be going into something of a death trap, will, if they want to continue and pursue this operation, have to use ground forces. I think particularly recently in Syria and Iraq, we've seen that American air power against ISIS, for instance, is, although it's heavy and very sophisticated, has not actually had much effect on the ground. This is just a fact of warfare. So bad for the Saudis is it, well, difficult for the Saudis as it may be, it seems they've either got to pursue that course or in some ways stand down, and it doesn't look as though they're going to do that at the moment. They seem to have gone into this with their eyes open. As you correctly reported, 150,000 troops made up of various nations, mostly Saudis, are amassing, and it does look from the moment, if one was to predict, the new battlefield may be Aden, which has been a battlefield so often before, and where famously in the 1950s, the British fought a battle on the ground which went into British military history.
According to a report in the official Saudi news agency, Al Arabiya, Yemeni leader Abd Mansour al-Hadi appeared Thursday in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. According to Al Arabiya, Hadi left Yemen under Saudi protection after the kingdom began military operations Wednesday. Earlier this week, the Saudis began airstrikes into Yemen against the rebel forces who have been gaining ground against the remains of the government. That coalition also includes the U.S., which says it's trying to help the embattled president. At least one analyst said the U.S. is directly involved. International law analyst Barry Grossman told Press TV on Friday that, quote, providing targeting intelligence and logistical support to a belligerent bombing campaign being carried out by a U.S. client state in another sovereign nation using U.S.-supplied hardware is, in fact, direct participation in that military conflict, close quote. And according to Ajamu Baraka, a political analyst and frequent contributor to BlackAgendaReport.com, the U.S. is more interested in supporting a regime that allowed it to conduct drone strikes over its territory than it is in the lives and property of the people of Yemen.
It is unfortunate that the U.S. is not becoming more assertive in attempting to put a brake on the interests and the objectives of the Saudis. The U.S. cut a deal with the Houthi government to allow it to continue to participate, to fly its drones as part of its counter-terrorist operations. But they could be much more adamant in imposing a diplomatic and peaceful solution to what is now developing into a very violent and brutal civil war.
China's foreign ministry expressed, quote, profound concern, closed quote, about the situation in Yemen following Saudi Arabia's airstrikes on the capital, Sana'a. Foreign ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying said at a weekly press briefing Thursday that China has taken note of the attacks and, quote, is deeply worried about the situation in Yemen that is getting worse, closed quote. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad told Russian media Thursday that the U.S.-led alliance of some 60 countries that declared a plan to rid the world of the so-called Islamic State is not serious, saying that some of the coalition's members would prefer to retain the terrorist force as a weapon against their adversaries. Pointing to the support by the U.S., U.K., Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other members of the coalition for their own various terrorist groups in Syria, Libya, and elsewhere, the Syrian president said, quote, an anti-terrorist coalition cannot consist of countries which are themselves supporters of terrorism, closed quote. He said that the only way to put an end to the ongoing armed conflict in his country is for such countries as the U.S., Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and others to stop arming the terrorists. A violent response by the Canadian government to peaceful protests, including batons and tear gas being used against students in Quebec who were marching against austerity. RT's Matt Trezza has more.
Protests against impending budget cuts has brought tens of thousands of students to the streets in the Canadian province of Quebec, the latest demonstration facing a heavy-handed police response. Tear gas fired at hundreds of demonstrators who gathered outside the National Assembly in the regional capital, Quebec City. Police say they were forced to step in after activists didn't stick to the agreed plan for protest. The demonstrations were angry at the regional government's newly announced budget, the first to make it out of the red in 7 years. This comes at a cost with more than $700 million in cuts made, including from education, health and social services. Demonstrators demanding the budget be scrapped. A march in Quebec City Tuesday ended with police using tear gas and rubber bullets. Dozens were arrested. The same day, thousands marched in Montreal against a new budget, with it too ending in clashes with police.
A giveaway of marijuana seeds in the nation's capital drew thousands, and organizers said the action is legal under the city's new law. This was organizer Adam Eidinger, chair of the DC Cannabis Campaign, Thursday.
What makes it legal is that people can possess up to 2 ounces of marijuana anywhere in the city that's on public property or private property that's not federal land. People have the legal right to grow marijuana in DC. You can grow up to 6 plants, 12 in a household. but you you know, you can only give it away. You can't sell it.
There was a wide variety of free cannabis seeds available.
We got a mix of some indica, some sativas. We got some New York Purple Train Wreck. Let's see, what else? MedMax OG times Delano. There's a lot of good stuff.
Organizers said that if everyone present were to grow their own seeds, the results would be more than 10,000 new plants in the city. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was set to wrap up his visit to Latin America, which began Monday with a trip to Havana and included a number of stops, with Thursday's venue being Managua, Nicaragua. For more on that and an update of other news and events in the region, we go to Managua to speak with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
In general, the news here has been dominated by a couple of things here in Nicaragua anyway, and Nicaragua continues to give very strong support to Venezuela against President Obama's decree declaring Venezuela a threat to the national security of the United States, like the rest of the region.
Yeah, everybody, yep.
And we've also had a visit from the foreign minister of the Russian Federation, Sergei Lavrov, who was in the country. I think he was here the day before yesterday, and I think today he's gone to a meeting in Guatemala of the right. Central American Integration System.
Right. They'll see. He's Russia apparently is seeking observer status as a member of that. That's right.
Yeah. So and Central America isn't a very big region. I should imagine the total population's probably not much more than about 25 million, something like that, when you add them all up.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, it's strategically, historically, it's always been a very important region from the point of view, certainly from the point of view of the United States. And so the visit by Russia's foreign minister takes on some significance in the context of U.S. concerns in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And also in terms of the way Latin American countries are developing their own independent foreign policy that isn't constantly looking over its shoulder at what the U.S. State Department might think.
Mm.
So, yeah, and the main example of that in the region has been the incredible solidarity across the region with Venezuela against President Obama's presidential decree.
Yeah, I think every public forum that has featured any member of the leadership of just about any Latin American or Caribbean country in the last 3 weeks or however long it's been since that decree, you're seeing this really strong statement of support. And last time I looked, I don't know, there were 3.5 or 4 million signatures on that petition that started going around last Friday asking Obama to repeal his determination.
Yeah, that's the figure that I saw, well over 3 million. So, you know, who knows what impact those kinds of public initiatives have on policy that's really not even decided by the U.S. president, but rather by the sinister powers that in the background that tend to control presidential policy. But in the region, yesterday, a document was distributed from the CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which is a body that was founded largely as a result of the vision of President Hugo Chavez Frias, of the former Venezuelan president. And they've issued a statement that condemning in the most categoric terms the declaration by President Obama and insisting on a process of dialogue to normalize relations between the United States and Venezuela. So, and that's really important because the community of Latin American and Caribbean states includes even countries that are regarded very much as allies of the United States, like Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile.
Yep.
And they all signed up to that agreement, expressing a very clear rejection of President Obama's declaration attacking Venezuela.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting, too, Lavrov is the consummate diplomat. He's, you know, he's a very sharp guy and speaks very deliberately. But he made statements in several countries on his stop. I think he was going to four or five countries while he was here. He landed in Cuba Monday or Tuesday, and he's leaving from Guatemala, right? Made it very clear on several occasions that he is there in solidarity with the nations of the region, standing for the principle of non-interference.
Right. Yeah, and he... And that, but that's always been, and as far as I can remember, and ever since President Vladimir Putin came to office in the Russian Federation, when was his first period of office back in 2000,
right,
something like that. But ever since then, I mean, the consistent policy of President Vladimir Putin has been one of ratifying the fundamental conventions in international human rights law, which are the United Nations Declaration of 1948, right, and the two protocols on civil and political rights and social, economic and cultural rights that most countries signed back in the 50s, and all these fundamental documents of international law that the United States and its Western allies are now trying to rubbish and roll back, and Russia and its allies are very strongly defending those fundamental principles that were won at the cost of so much human suffering over the last couple of centuries. And that fundamental position of non-aggression, non-intervention in the internal affairs of other states is absolutely central to those, to that body of international law, isn't it? And that's been well established for decades. And now the United States and its allies are just trying to ignore it all and pretend that it doesn't happen or is no longer relevant. And you actually get, I remember reading documents some years ago in which senior military officials and senior political functionaries in the United States system were trying to say that international law is now obsolete and has to be rethought, you know, as if you can just throw out centuries of accumulated wisdom and experience because it's no longer convenient. And that essentially that's what Russia and its allies are resisting.
Yeah.
And they have strong support here in Latin America, because Latin America has, as everybody knows, historically suffered greatly as a result of intervention in its individual countries' internal affairs, not just from the United States, but historically also from the European powers as well.
Right.
So they have a strong interest in showing solidarity with Russia and presenting a united front in defense of fundamental principles of international law.
Hey, let me ask you something while we're on this. Just like for some speculation, wild speculation. in a period where Russia is warning the United States that it's nervous about all of the military aerial activity going on over Poland and other bordering areas of Russian Federation, how far we are from joint military exercises with the Russian Federation, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, etc. How far do you think we are from that? And assuming that ever comes to pass, what kind of a response can we expect from the United States of a dose of its own medicine?
It depends on context. So much depends on context, doesn't it? I mean, at the moment, Russia and Nicaragua have already held joint exercises in terms of combating organized crime. And that's something that people in the United States may not be well aware of, the extent to which the Russian Federation has assisted Nicaragua in building up its security system and its ability to address the problems presented by organized crime, and in particular by narcotics,
right,
smuggling. And I think Russia has supplied equipment, including high-speed launches, to the Nicaraguan army, which And Nicaragua doesn't have a separate navy as such. It's such a small country. Its armed forces are dominated by its land forces, the army, and so that the army has subsidiary branches that deal with coastal protection and a small air force that's mostly helicopter based. So the Russian Federation has assisted Nicaragua to reinforce its military hardware so that it's better able to cope with the threats presented by organized crime and extremely well-equipped narcotic smugglers.
And those are, of course, do multiple use, the weapons, the training, the organizing. If you can stop people from smuggling cocaine through your country, for example, you can also stop them from smuggling weapons for another Contra war or whatever.
Yeah, I'm one of the, and I can see Russia, the Russian Federation and Nicaragua and other countries as well, not just Nicaragua, but also Guatemala. And it's, people may not realize that Guatemala actually has a strong bilateral relationship with the Russian Federation as well, despite being a country generally governed by what are regarded as right-wing governments.
Right.
So, it's not out of the question that Russia will increase its assistance to its security assistance to Guatemala, for example. So, and what you're likely to see from the Russian Federation is an extremely nuanced approach to developing its security cooperation with countries in Central America and the Caribbean. And it's obviously, its long history with Cuba has already established a very strong context in which it will be perfectly legitimate. And obviously, in absolute terms, it's obviously perfectly legitimate. But taking into account United States anxieties, and Russia has for a long time been a source of security support for the Cuban government.
Oh, yeah.
And that's being reinforced here in Nicaragua. It's likely to be reinforced throughout the region generally, because one of the things that is significant about Sergei Lavrov's meeting with the Central American Integration System is precisely that Russia is trying to develop its relations across the region, not just with individual countries that may or may not have long historical relationships with the Russian Federation as a result of the history of the Soviet Union. So will that extend down to Venezuela? And I think you're probably quite right to suggest that in the next few years there'll be joint exercises between Venezuelan forces, Nicaraguan and Cuban forces, but possibly other countries as well. Because Russia, because it's very aware of U.S. concerns in the region, it's probably not going to try and develop an obvious front that the United States ideologues could interpret as threatening United States interests. And the point of view that the Russian Federation is likely to develop in the region is that it's working jointly with all the countries in the region, and perhaps including the United States at some point, to increase security and increase the measures against organized narcotics.
Yeah, and this is a similar strategy probably on a little larger scale, but to the way China has approached it as well in terms of security. They make it as generic as possible, as non block oriented, at least overtly as possible, and so the response to that, though, I mean, the United States has different, the mature neoliberal economic imperialist model has different needs than the Russian and Chinese economies and these developing countries' economies. It needs to retain colonial relations with these regions that are historically their colonial domain, and the protection of the sovereignty of these countries that have spun out of that orbit guarantees, without a war, that they will remain outside, and that is a that is damaging to their imperialist model. So, I mean, it's still a confrontation. That's my point. And I'm wondering if the new method of warfare that the United States has been using since the 90s of, in any event, has been really developing since the 90s, of going after regime change as opposed to conventional war modes, if that's why we're seeing so much of that in Central America and South America, Caribbean, now from the United States, all these pushes on all these different fronts.
Yeah, there's certainly a strong contrast between the two approaches by the Russian Federation and China on the one hand with their Latin American policy and the policy of the United States in the region and also, and to some extent, the European Union too. Because whereas the Russian Federation and China use what in the United States people call soft power to develop the whole range of relations with states. In here we're talking in a Latin American context, but it's the same wherever you look in different regions around the world, Africa or Southeast Asia or wherever.
That's true, right.
And so, for example, Sergei Lavrov in his public appearance with Daniel Ortega the other day stressed that Russia is building up its relationships with countries in the whole of Central America across the region in commercial terms, in terms of cultural relations, right. For example, and the Russian Federation offers scholarships to students from different countries in the region, not just Nicaragua but also Guatemala. And so they're building up these development cooperation relationships very much in the spirit of the United Nations policy. And if you read United Nations policy documents on the legal commitments the United Nations member states undertake, and the Russian Federation and China work very much in tune with those legal and moral obligations, and so they're developing their relations with countries in Central America across the board. And that point that you made about how the United States is trying to shift the way it levers its enormous power in the region through regime change operations that of the kind that we've seen, for example, in the Ukraine, of the kind that's going on right now in Venezuela, of the kind that they're trying to develop in Argentina, and to some extent too, and I don't think there's any doubt that they're trying to develop a similar kind of operation in Brazil.
Sure.
And if you can, and that's in sharp contrast to the way Russia and China address their policy in terms of development cooperation and relations generally with states in Latin America, but the European Union as well, although it doesn't use, it's not so involved so directly as the United States in these kind of regime change operations, which are just, you know, they're just a more sophisticated version of an old style coup.
Right.
The European Union uses its huge economic power to try and bully countries in different regions of the world. And we've seen this in Latin America with regard to the agreement of association with the European Union, whereby the European Union dangles carrots in front of relatively poor countries like the countries in Latin America. And in exchange for extracting quite significant economic concessions. Both Daniel Ortega and Sergei Lavrov mentioned that general area, and Sergei Lavrov specifically said that, among other things, they were hoping for a complete normalization of the relations between Cuba and the United States, a definitive end to the blockade. But he also said very specifically that the Russian Federation rejects the use of kind of soft coups, this kind of regime change, right. Quite aggressive regime change without actually involving a military invasion.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.